So Irving Kristol then, and I start with the question of what does it mean to think for oneself? So Isaac Newton is famously pictured under a tree, the notion of gravity having occurred to him by the fall of an apple, and I quote, as he sat in contemplative mood. And that's what he told his biographer. But Newton knew that his contemplative mind had already been honed at British schools and Cambridge University. And paying tribute to the scientists and philosophers who taught him how to think, he said, if I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. An independent mind is cultivated by a tradition of intellectual independence, and it's enabled by a society that allows such minds their freedom. Now, a caricature of Irving Kristol might show a similar eureka moment. In the first frame, he would be strolling in liberal contentment, like the contemplative astrologer who fell into a well. And in the second frame, he would be held up at gunpoint under a speech bubble that says, "Today I am a neoconservative." Anyway, the association of Irving Kristol with that insight, the neoconservative is a liberal who was mugged by reality, persists because it is also, it explains a directional principle that once enunciated seems obvious. Newton's scheme moves vertically in physics and Kristol's horizontally in politics. And among the clear-eyed community of thinkers that we're studying, Irving Kristol set a standard for plain thinking about the complex problems of the time. And I would say he is crystal clear. And I ask, I couldn't be the first one to come up with that, could I? But if I am, I claim it proudly. Anyway, we begin then by recognizing the exceptional quality of Irving Kristol's thinking that prompted one of his admirers to call him the common man's uncommon intellectual, which speaks to the way that he lived ideas rather than just wrote about them. Kristol believed that the animating importance of ideas applied not only to intellectuals, but to the general public. So he wrote, "The political ideas that men have always help to shape the political reality they live in. And this is so whether these be habitual opinions, tacit convictions, or explicit ideologies. It is ideas that establish and define in men's minds the categories of the politically possible and the politically impossible, the desirable and the undesirable, the tolerable and the intolerable." And he led us through this minefield of alternatives, and I think that people followed confidently because of how carefully he cleared the path. So Irving Kristol was born, as some of you do know, in New York in 1920, and he lived a life so much in keeping with his ideas that his autobiographical memoir of 1995 organically combines the two, life and ideas. It's the biography of a man in harmony with himself, not in love with himself, which can lead to intellectual hubris, but at home with himself, in the same way that he's at home with his formative upbringing. His Yiddish-speaking immigrant parents seem to have taken their Jewishness so much for granted that they could afford to ignore its rituals. And this evolved into his own non-practicing orthodoxy. Yet his parents did make sure that in addition to public school, he also attended Jewish afternoon school so that he learned to read the Bible in Hebrew and learned the prayers. And so he was able to recite the Kaddish for his mother, who died when he was 16. When his interest in Judaism and religion deepened in the later years, he built on this foundation. And while he never became a Jewish scholar, he was able to write knowledgeably about the Jews as they were and as they interacted with the world. Now, Kristol took the route that most New York boys from poor families took. He attended local city college, where he was drawn into one of those famous alcoves of argument. He was drawn into the Trotskyist group that opposed the Stalinist one that was beside it. And his description of this political initiation actually makes him seem as if he were quite passive. He claims simply to have followed where his friends led. But he was already the independent thinker that he became in later years, and he remained an admirer of communism only until his very early 20s. One of the things that changed him was serving as an infantryman in Europe. When he returned to civilian life, he began his lifelong career as editor, writer, and critic at Commentary between the years 1947 and 52, in England as co-editor of Encounter from 53 to 58, and then as founding editor and publisher of leading American journals, The Public Interest and The National Interest. The description public intellectual suits him best because that's how he positioned himself, thinking from the perspective of someone who stands at the center of the American polity. In later life, when he and his wife moved from New York to Washington, their decision was in keeping with the increasingly public role that he was playing in American life. Now, New York might be the hotbed of theater and art, but Washington was the seat of government, and their move helped the city, as I quote, inch along toward greater hospitality to the life of the mind. Once again, in making that move, his life and ideas were perfectly aligned. Now, Crystal did not say very much about his army service in Europe and how it affected his thinking, but a short piece that he wrote after the war called Adam and I gives us an early sense of how he thought at the time. It describes his first post-war meeting with a survivor of Auschwitz in the spring of 1945 at Zionist headquarters in Marseille. He mistakes this 17-year-old for someone 26, older than he was at the time. Adam is a slippery character in no hurry to get to Palestine. He says because he needs first to return to Poland, where his father is still presumably alive, the only member to have survived of that family. Adam admits that he is hitting on this American Jewish soldier only because he needs things from him, specifically a gun. Our author realizes that for this kid who has learned to live on the sly, he is nothing but a soft touch, and he will never be anything more. Now, Henry James had already dealt much more fully with this theme of innocent Americans who have to come to grips with European cunning. But here it is the young Jew's turn to stop being naive. He is stripped of false pride and false humility, of false illusions about who the liberated Jew is likely to be, and he's stripped of false illusions about himself. The presumed American Jewish liberator. He knows he is being used, and he decides to let himself be used by supplying this boy with the weapon that he wants. So Adam is not the heroic Zionist youth headed to reclaim the Jewish homeland, and he, the writer, is not heroic, perhaps like those American Jews who went to fight for Israel's independence. But setting scruples and doubts aside, he acts. He acts to help a fellow Jew. I would say a small step for man, but a giant step for an intellectual. So when it comes to Crystal's integration of experience and ideas, the role of family is paramount. I've said in previous talks that a number of the New York intellectuals cultivated the role of the perpetual Jewish son that became a staple of American Jewish culture. Now contrast this with Irving Kristol, who describes meeting Gertrude Himmelfarb, known as B, at a political meeting when they were both in college, and after a brief courtship, entering into what their friend Daniel Bell described as, quote, the best marriage of our generation. This was a marriage of equals. Gertrude Himmelfarb is a distinguished historian of British intellectual thought. They raised two strong children, one of whom, Bill Kristol, carries on his parents' work. Irving Kristol was an exemplary husband and father and powerful mentor, as we have heard, mentor of enough interns to give the impression of having transformed a generation. Kristol was the father or the godfather of neoconservatism because although he denied that he had fathered a movement, he led it with such authority and wielded such influence that it was perceived as a movement nonetheless. So here we have an intellectual very different from the European types of nonconformist or alienated outsider or dissenter. At the heart of neoconservatism is what we recognize as the Jewish model of the intellectual reader. Leader like a rabbi who speaks from the inside of his own society and assumes early on the responsibilities of husband and father and who thinks for the entire people. Writing about Kristol, the social scientist James Q. Wilson said that the most radical cultural division in all of history was that between the attachment that ordinary people have for the family and the hostility that intellectuals display toward it. Now, if that is the case, Kristol's example of the fully integrated familial intellectual may have been even greater than the sum of his ideas. But turning now from the man to his writings, I will go back to where we left off last time with the young Marxists who came to realize the enormous harm that their ideology caused. Irving Kristol's essay, Civil Liberties, 1952, A Study in Confusion, published in Commentary when Kristol was 32 years old, remained his most controversial essay until his death 57 years later. By the time he wrote it, communist subversion had been exposed in the public trials of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and Alger Hiss. The House Committee on Un-American Activities, originally founded in the 1930s to investigate both fascism and communism, was by then focused strictly on the Red Scare and had extended its scrutiny from those who were formally spying for Moscow to affiliated communists in Hollywood and the universities who were propagandizing for the Soviet regime. Now, as the entertainment industry and higher education began blacklisting or firing people named at the hearings, and as Senator Joe McCarthy made sweeping allegations about hundreds of communist agents in the State Department, they damaged some of the credibility of the investigations, and the left used that prosecutorial overkill to turn the accusation around. So it's McCarthyism that became a synonym for witch hunting, and the Red Scare tactics became an excuse for dismissing its dangers. Some called McCarthyism a greater danger to American democracy than the communists that it was hunting. And this is what Kristol meant by a study in confusion. And this is the minefield that he navigates between the domestic communists and McCarthy supporters. He puts the matter very succinctly. Do we defend our rights by protecting communism? No, he says, we do not. And in fact, this is how he puts it. It is a calamitous error to believe that because a vulgar demagogue lashes out at both communism and liberalism as identical, it is necessary to protect communism in order to defend liberalism. This way of putting the matter will surely shock liberals who are convinced that it is only they who truly understand communism and who thoughtfully oppose it. They are nonetheless mistaken, and it is a mistake on which McCarthyism waxes fat. For there is one thing that the American people know about Senator McCarthy. He, like them, is unequivocally anti-communism. about the spokesman for American liberalism, they feel no such thing, and with some justification. And if you think that this begins to apply in some way to the contemporary situation, I will certainly not join the dots. But those last sentences are probably the most widely quoted of all Crystal's writings. Liberals, he says, consider the vulgar demagogue a greater threat than communism, which they treat as simply a political trend that should be granted competitive rights. But the rest of the country sees communism for what it is, quote, a movement guided by conspiracy and aiming at totalitarianism rather than merely another form of dissent. So while standing between political evils and having to choose between them, the American people wisely chooses the lesser evil over the greater, which is more than can be said for New York liberals, who would never forgive Crystal for exposing their folly. When Crystal wrote, "This way of putting the matter will surely shock liberals," even he did not anticipate the storm that this essay would cause. His liberal readers were prepared for an attack on the bad guys, on the communists, but they were not prepared for an attack on them. They considered themselves the moderates between the warring camps who endorsed a reasoned politics of decency, virtue, and integrity. This essay redefined their place on the political continuum. By accommodating the communists, liberals had betrayed constitutional democracy, which would have required opposition to both totalitarian systems, communism and fascism. So Crystal denies them their sweet spot in the middle, and he does it in the measured, temperate style that they associate with their own cause. He writes, "The problem of fighting communism while preserving civil liberties is no simple one, and there is no simple solution. A prerequisite for any solution, however, is firstly, a proper understanding of communism for what it is, and secondly, a sense of proportion." So as long as liberals believe that one must choose between complete civil liberties for everyone and a disregard for civil liberties entirely, democracy will fail. First, evil must be recognized and defined, that evil in this case being communism as an idea and in practice. And second, a sense of proportion must be preserved even among different levels of sin and crime. McCarthy may be prepared to smear dissenters and subversives with the same brush, making no differentiation between them. But liberals do something even worse when they refuse to discriminate between free thought and underground conspiracy. I'm speaking here in his voice, right? This is his essay. Now, liberals never forgave him because they sensed the irreparable harm that he had done to their cause and moral self-esteem. Crystal's conservatism, you see, began very early on by forcing liberals to confront the evil that they did not want to acknowledge, the war that they did not want to have to fight. In the case of fascism, one, of course, point to the newsreels of the crematoria. It was not hard to point out what the evils of fascism were. But Crystal performs the much harder task of unmasking the evil that masquerades as good. Now, it's hard, I think, to exaggerate the importance of this shift of emphasis from perpetrators to enablers, since by the 1950s, with fascism defeated and the Cold War between America and the Soviet Union just starting up, it was indeed the enablers rather than any Soviet spies who were undermining American self-confidence, and they were doing it through the ever-expanding part of the academy, the media, and the intellectual elites. Philip Selznick, an almost exact contemporary and lifelong friend of Crystal's, who became a prominent sociologist and professor at the University of California in Berkeley, describes how, whenever they faced, the two of them, whenever they faced a new intellectual and political challenge, they looked for thinkers who could offer them guidance. It's not a bad rule of thumb. So he writes, as we contemplated the moral ruin in the Soviet Union and the responsibilities of Leninism for that failure, we felt seared by the breath of evil. In response, we earnestly sought a better understanding of human nature, leadership, organization, and mass politics. We turned to writers in theology and social theory for help in articulating a deeper appreciation for the dilemmas and frustrations of social idealism. Those writers helped us understand the irresponsible role of power and domination in human affairs, the tyranny of means over ends, the subversion of good intentions by unintended consequences, and the recalcitrance and frailty of people and institutions, and above all, the insidious collusion of good and evil. Now, they went to writers who helped them identify that insidious collusion of good and evil. And then they proceeded to make similar distinctions in their thinking, thinking for themselves while standing on the shoulders of giants. I think they became the giants for many of the rest of us. Now, Crystal writes, it requires strength of character to act upon one's ideas. It requires no less strength of character to resist being seduced by them. And he shows by example how this is done. So let me give just two examples of this. Take the passage of civil rights legislation in the 1960s to eliminate all traces of discrimination on the basis of race, color, or creed. This great idea of equality before the law was shanghaied almost immediately by those who substituted the goal of equal outcome for colorblind equal opportunity. Under the motto of affirmative action, a policy of group preferences was introduced into the universities, many of which raced to embrace what they called diversity. Crystal saw the penetration of quotas for what it was, and he wrote this in 1974. Who would have thought 20 or even 10 years ago that we in the United States would live to see the day when a governmental agency would ask institutions of higher learning to take a racial census of their faculties, specifying the proportion of Indo-Europeans, traditionally just another name for Aryans. And who could have anticipated that this would happen with little public controversy and with considerable support from the liberal community? How on earth did this fantastic situation come about? The main foes, then, of American constitutional democracy were no longer the Ku Klux Klan and neo-fascists, but some of the same elites that once discriminated against minorities and now practiced reverse discrimination for those they deemed to be underprivileged. He was appalled by liberal Jews who had fought for the original legislation and who did not see the danger of this inversion to themselves and to those dependents. Here was a case when the claim of unfairness of American democracy was used to promote unfair and racist practices. Another such twisted accusation hammered at the economic disparity as the original sin of the American way of life. Now, the classic version of the American dream, of course, taught that every child, whatever its starting circumstance, could, with proper encouragement and strong character, work its way up the economic and social ladder. America was a classless land of opportunity that generated prosperity. Egalitarians, channeling socialist ideas, recast the American dream as the American nightmare that allowed some to wax rich at the expense of the exploited poor, who sank into a permanent underclass. If ideas drove politics, then Americans were going to have to relearn the healthy connection in capitalism between economic and political freedom, or they would forfeit their moral advantage. Capitalism may be imperfect, but it remains preferable to a perfect idea that translates into tyranny when put into practice. Common sense, based on moral realism, must resist utopian engineering or, quote, social idealism. And here is Crystal on this point. I know the question of equality is something that many religious people are quite obsessed with. Here I will simply plead my Jewishness and say, equality has never been a Jewish thing. Rich men are fine, poor men are fine, so long as they are decent human beings. I do not like equality. I do not like it in sports, in the arts, or in economics. I just don't like it in this world. So, passages such as this that seem deliberately and playfully provocative always appear in the context of well-argued essays and speeches that warn against the egalitarian temptation. Representing the conservative temperament as cheerful and good-humored, Crystal knows that people are endlessly susceptible to appeals to what they mistake for their better nature, and he does his best to correct that error. Now, when Irving Crystal edited his last collection of essays under the title Neoconservatism, The Autobiography of an Idea, he conflated his own intellectual evolution with that of the neoconservative persuasion, persuasion being the word that he uses instead of movement. Persuasion is not to be mistaken for a competitive ideology. Its immediate purpose is to reinvigorate this existing nation, to reinforce what's already good in American democracy. The union that had once been forged by workable ideas had now to be redefended by ideas. And the same holds true for the Jewish way of life. Now, here we come to one of the ways in which Crystal is at his most original. As his expertise expanded from politics to, quote, economics, sociology, philosophy, history, anthropology, and so forth, it led him time and again to the way these subjects come together in rabbinic Judaism. The essays in his book are under the headings Race, Sex, and Family, From Adversary Culture to Counterculture, Capitalism and the Democratic Idea, The Conservative Prospect, and then the final section on Jews, which is not there as an afterthought, but as a culmination. Among the other New York intellectuals, even some of them who were closest to Crystal in their writings and in their thinking, only a few included Jewishness prominently among their concerns, and fewer still made it the consummation of their intellectual journey. Now, how did this happen to him? He was not a Baal Tshuva, a person who has turned back to religious observance. His brother-in-law, Milton Himmelfarb, to whom we will be devoting a lecture later on, must have been a marvelous interlocutor, but unlike Himmelfarb, Crystal was not part of an intense Jewish community. He does not seem to have been transformed by powerful attachment to Israel, nor was he traumatically affected by the Holocaust. He just followed his inquiries, that independent mind, to their logical resolution. It was rather the steady search for wisdom and truth that brought him to the intellectual love of Judaism as the highest blessedness to which humans can aspire. Now, to emphasize the importance of this, I hope you don't mind, I would like to refer back to Middle of the Journey. I'm determined that this is a novel that everyone's going to get to read if I keep mentioning it. This novel of 1947 by Lionel Trilling. I mentioned last time that this novel follows the same political journey that Crystal and others had taken. The novel's main character, John Laskell, who is speaking in the voice of Lionel Trilling. He is the main character, and is up against another character by the name of Gifford Maxim, that is based on the real-life character of Whittaker Chambers, who had just defected from the Communist Party. Chambers had been running a spy network. All of this is real. He had been running a spy network in the United States, and at the height of the Soviet purges, he felt a moral revulsion so powerful that he broke with communism. The climax of the novel is a showdown between Laskell and Maxim, Reed, Trilling, and Chambers, over what happens after the break from communism, namely, what is going to happen in liberal America. So Laskell's position is very much like Crystal's in that 1952 essay on civil liberties. He is the first among all his fellow liberal leftists to acknowledge that the Soviet Union is really as evil as Maxim says it is, and that there must be no compromise with its claim to be serving humankind. But what then? What remains when this great organizing idea of progress collapses? Now, Maxim has found an alternative. He says, "My community with men is that we are children of God." This is the language of Christianity for him. And Maxim, like the real Whittaker Chambers, had become a devout Christian. Now, the others think he's gone out of his mind. They cannot believe that anyone in their intellectual circle could return to religion. They are ultimately less shaken by Maxim's revelations about the Soviet Union than they are by his emergence as a Christian believer. And although Laskell doesn't call him crazy, he too firmly opposes this choice. The novel says about Laskell, he had been brought up without religious belief, and the words had no force of childhood reminiscence. Now, whether or not this absence of childhood exposure to Judaism kept Lionel Trilling distant from Jewishness, it became one of the profound points of difference between him and Irving Kristol, who not only remained deeply attached to the Jewishness of his childhood, but came as an adult to admire its wisdom. Laskell, like Trilling, remains proudly secular, proud not to have succumbed to the temptation of religious faith. He thinks that moving from communism to Christianity is merely the exchange of one hermetic system for another, and that remaining free of both is the mark of the true intellectual. Because Trilling was not able to make his character Jewish, he could not do this convincingly, so he didn't do it at all. So he makes him an unaffiliated American with absolutely no ethnic or religious identity. Here is his syllogism. Religious faith is represented by Christianity. Christianity is merely the inverse of communism. Therefore, the Jewish intellectual must repudiate religious faith. I think that some New York intellectuals likewise felt that they were affirming their Jewishness by repudiating Christianity and with it religion in general. Now, Irving Kristol thinks very differently. Had he been allowed to speak in this novel, he might have said, "I share the Christians' embrace of religion, but oppose communism from the more realistic perspective of the rabbinic Jew. But why should I put words in his mouth when that is, in effect, what he says in his 1979 talk to theologians on Christianity, Judaism, and socialism?" He says, "I am non-practicing, non-observant, as we say, but in principle very sympathetic to the spirit of orthodoxy. When I talk about religion, I talk as an insider, but when I talk about Christianity, I think it will be very clear that I talk as an outsider. When I say that I'm not a Christian, I do not say it polemically, of course, but whether one is Jewish or Christian does, it seems to me, affect one's attitude toward capitalism." In other words, let's not conflate religions, and let's not pit religion against secularism, because that is not the fundamental dividing line. Once again, as in the essay of civil liberties, Crystal realigns the categories of our discussion. So rabbinic Judaism differs from Christianity in its attitude towards commerce and financial success. He writes, Orthodox Jews have never despised business. Christians have. The act of commerce, the existence of a commercial society, has always been a problem for Christians, not for Jews. Getting rich has never been regarded as being in any way sinful, degrading, or morally dubious within the Jewish religion, so long as such wealth is acquired legally and used responsibly. Judaism's goal of fulfilling human potential to the utmost must include making a good living. This attitude is part of Jewish moral realism, which tries to build a good society for human beings as they are. The reason for singling out capitalism is that it is so far the best proven economic system for fulfilling human potential to the utmost. And that is likewise why America is a capitalist country and why Jews do so well in it. Understood this way, if we understand it in this way, you can see why, as between rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, the former's attitude to success is actually better suited to America, right? But how Jews behave economically is for him part of a much larger issue. We are talking about an eternal debate about the nature of reality, about the nature of human authenticity, a debate between making the world, making the best of the world as it is, and those in metaphysical rebellion who wish to liberate us from the prison of the world. This is a tension, he says, that exists within all religions, Judaism included, and one that extends, of course, into secular modernity. Orthodoxy is the term that Crystal uses for moral realism that tries to give answers to questions that are unanswerable. That is, questions of why we live in a world that is unfair. One could also call this conservatism or the neoconservative persuasion. Pushing against this view are the rebellious or Gnostic movements that want to redeem human beings from a condition that they perceive to be inhuman. Gnostic systems, like Kabbalism among the Jews, believe that our material world is just a debased result of the divine spark having fallen into a lower state, and that ideal human potential must be released from it. So crudely stated, matter would be evil and the realm of spirit is the good. In Judaism, this is only a sectarian position, and Kabbalists were permitted to argue these ideas only after the age of 40. But the redemptive impulse plays a much larger role in Christianity, and here's the crux, it assumes a dominant role in socialism that transposes this ideal of transcending human error into economic terms. Once Jews cease to follow the Jewish way of life, they become exceedingly susceptible to the progressivist temptation. So, Crystal acknowledges the temptations, the attractions of idealism, of socialism, and the prophetic Judaism. They want to realize on this earth a universal vision of the vision of Isaiah. The same impatience with rabbinic Judaism that once animated the early Christians comes up again in modern Jews who want to repair the world. As against the growing atomization of modern society, these movements offer all kinds of things. They offer a sense of community. He mentions the kibbutz. As compared with the apparent selfishness of capitalism that concentrates on individual economic well-being, these movements promise to help the needy. They make you feel like a better person because of it. Yet he is persuaded that the rabbinic attitude is true to human nature and the other is false. And because it is false, it will end in tyranny that insists on forcing its idea of perfection on societies that cannot meet its standards. The older forms of tyranny of a Roman emperor European monarch or the Russian Tsar, these gave way to egalitarian tyranny. Both alike destroy the rough balance that rabbinic Judaism and American constitutional democracy have achieved. Now, I also suggest to you that if you want a really marvelous read of Crystal's theology or theological ideas, you will find it in Matthew Continetti's article on this subject in National Affairs, and I think in the summer of 2014. I would really love to put it side by side with this because he really goes through the ideas quite systematically and wonderfully. But here to conclude then, in 1983, Irving Kristol wrote, "It is the self-imposed assignment of neoconservatism to explain to the American people why they are right and to intellectuals why they are wrong." I put that up in lights. He did better than that by supplying a new version of the responsible intellectual that derives from the rabbinic tradition and from America's founding thinkers who owed a great deal to that part of the Jewish tradition. So great rabbis teach the Talmud and teach Jewish tradition to persuade us of its great wisdom. But they start out with the premise that rabbinic Judaism is the chosen way of life. Irving Kristol started his intellectual journey in college with an opposite revolutionary ideal, and he thought his way through to the wisdom of rabbinic Judaism. He did not want to impose a Jewish vocabulary on America, but the neoconservative persuasion and rabbinic Judaism are aligned in his ideal of the sound way of life on earth. Thank you. Well, I don't think it ever gets any better than this, an occasion to celebrate Norman Podhoretz and Midge Dechter, and to do so under these auspices. We are in the building that once housed Commentary and that is now the home of Tikva, and we are in the presence of New York's most distinguished intellectual couple, by a long shot, among some of their family, colleagues, friends, and admirers.